This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our program. We're reading from Ernest Gaines' novel, A Lesson Before Dying. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and will be made available in podcast after the broadcast. We're pleased to present these dramatic readings of A Lesson Before Dying using a cast of volunteer readers. Feel free to call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
Vivian stood at the back door, looking across the yard toward the field, where some of the cane had been cut. The cane had not been hauled to the derrick yet, and it was lying across in rows. A little farther over, there was another patch of cane, standing, tall and blue-green. You could see the leaves swaying softly in the breeze. After warming the coffee, I poured each of us a cupful. I cut two slices from the chocolate cake my aunt had in the safe, then we sat down at the table, facing the yard and the field. "It's really peaceful," Vivian said. "Sunday's the saddest day of the week. Not for those who have to work in the field. It has always been for me. You ought to find something to do on Sunday, like going to church." I didn't answer her. "I know you believe," she said. "You don't want to, but I know you do. The only thing I believe in is loving you." We finished our cake and coffee, and I put the cups and saucers in a pan of soap and water on the window shelf. "We ought to wash them," Vivian said. "They're okay." "No," she said. "It's not fair to her. You wash, I'll dry." "It's going to be like that, huh?" "Uh-huh," she said. There was hot water in the kettle on the stove, and I poured some into the dishpan. Vivian had already taken down another pan from the wall, and I poured the rest of the hot water into it. She added cold water from the faucet by the icebox. I washed and rinsed the dishes, and she dried them and put them into the safe. It felt good doing this with her. "Is that enough?" I asked when we'd finished. "Or do you want me to sweep out the kitchen and mop, too?" She looked down at the floor. "I don't think so," she said. "It looks pretty clean." We'd been playing. Now I became serious. "How long can you stay?" "I have some time. Would you like to go for a walk down the corridor?" She nodded. "But first I must go back to your little girl's house." I nodded toward the toilet, which was set on the ditch near the cane field. She left the kitchen, and I went to my room and put on a warmer shirt. I also got my knife, in case she wanted a piece of sugar cane. I was standing on the porch when she came back in from the back. "Rustic enough out there for you?" "I've been in worse. I'm a country girl, remember?" We left the house. Up at the church, Reverend Ambrose had just started his termination song, Amazing Grace. We went down the corridor. Most of the people who'd not gone to church were indoors. Seldom was someone sitting out on the porch, and no one worked in the gardens or chopped wood in the yard. Horses and mules were grazing in the pastures beside and behind the houses, but that was about as much moving as you saw. Above, a low ashen sky loomed over the plantation, if not over the entire state of Louisiana. A swarm of blackbirds flew above the road and alighted in a pecan tree in one of the backyards to our left. The entire plantation was deadly quiet, except for the singing coming from the church up the quarter behind us. We crossed the railroad tracks and turned right. In front of us were three or four boxcars of sugarcane waiting to be picked up by the train and taken to the mill. We could also see the weighing scales left of the full boxcars and the derrick that lifted the cane from the wagons and the trailers and swung it onto the boxcars. Left of the weighing scales and the derrick was the plantation cemetery where my ancestors had been buried for the past century. The cemetery had lots of trees in it, pecans and oaks, and it was weedy too, and since there were so few gravestones, it was pretty hard to see many of the graves from the road. Just before we came up to the cemetery, we turned left on a road that would take us further into the field. This was Vivian's first time back here, and I told her that my people had worked these fields ever since slavery, and many of them were buried in the cemetery behind us. I asked her if she wanted a piece of cane, and she said yes. I jumped over the ditch and crossed a couple rows until I found a good stalk. Then I came back to where she was waiting for me. I cut off the first two joints and threw them away. They didn't look sweet enough. Then I peeled the third joint and tasted it. It was good. I cut off a round and gave it to Vivian. She chewed it and let some of the juice run down her chin the way a small child would do. The small child would not have been able to help it, but she could. I cut off a round for myself and chewed it. It was very soft, very sweet. We chewed cane and walked the road for at least 3/4 of a mile. Just before coming up to the gate that would lead to the swamp, I noticed a pecan tree to our right. I had picked pecans under that tree many times, and I suggested we go over there and see if we could find some. The tree stood at the headland of the cane field. We searched for pecans in the grass on the headland and walked down between the rows of cane. We found a couple of big ones, big and soft-shelled, and I cracked them by squeezing them together. I gave Vivian one half. I kept the other. We sat under the tree, and I cracked pecans for both of us. Suddenly, we were too quiet. "You want me here?" Vivian asked. I was not looking at her when she said it, and I could tell by her voice that she was not looking directly at me. "Yes," I said. She'd been gazing down at the ground. Now she raised her eyes to me. "That's what I want, too," she said. "I love you, Vivian," I said. "I want you to know that. I love you very much. I hope you love me as half as much as I love you." I left her for a while. When I came back, I saw that she had moved farther down between the rows, where the cane would hide us better. She'd taken off everything except her brassiere and slip. I took off everything except the heavy shirt, which I unbuttoned. Vivian raised her arms up and out to me as I lay down beside her. I lay on my side and I touched her brown nipples with my finger. Then I leaned over and kissed each tenderly, and raised up and looked at her. She was smiling at me. I went back and passed my tongue over each, and I kissed each again and rubbed my chin over them. My beard must have been rough, because I could feel her drawing away some, but when I looked at her, she was smiling again. I smiled back at her. "I think something happened," she said. "What do you mean?" "I have a strange feeling." I looked at her, and I felt happy, but my face must have changed. "What's the matter?" she said. "Nothing. But you frowned." "I'm happy." "But you frowned when I said it." "Maybe I was just thinking. I don't know if I want Paul to grow up here." "Don't spoil it," she said. "It's been too good. Don't spoil it." "I'm sorry, sweetheart." "And suppose it's Molly?" "No, it's Paul." "It could be Molly. Molly Wiggins." "I don't know if I like that name. You think it's a good name, Molly Wiggins?" "It sounds okay." "Sounds kind of whorish to me, Molly Wiggins." "Then let her decide. If she likes it, we'll keep it. If she doesn't, we'll call her Paulette." "Paul and Paulette? That sounds good. Maybe I'll have twins." "If not, we'll go till there is a Paulette." "She may be first." "Then we'll go till there's a Paul," I said. "You ought to put on something. You might catch cold." "Not if you hold me close. Not if you put that shirt round both of us." I lay upon her, kissing her hair, her eyes, her nose, her mouth.
Chapter 15. Vivian stood with her back to me while I brushed off her blazer and her skirt. A few small blades of yellow grass clung to her hair. I removed them and picked up her purse. I could see how clean the ground was where we had lain, and I could see where she had dug her heels into the ground. We left the field and started for the main road to return to the quarter. I had become colder, and we walked faster than when we had come out into the field. "We start our Christmas program next week," Vivian said. "It's about that time, huh?" "You're having a program, aren't you?" "I don't know. I hadn't given it much thought." "You only have about a month." "I guess I'll mention it to the children tomorrow. I'll see what they want. That stuff in Bayonne's been keeping me so busy, I've just about forgotten everything else."
"When are you going to see him again?"
I don't know. His nanan, my aunt, and their pastor are going up there tomorrow. I'll probably go Friday. I don't know. You have any idea? She said, not looking at me directly. I thought I knew what she was talking about. It's up to the big boss in Baton Rouge, I said. Vivian was quiet. We crossed the railroad tracks and entered the quarter. People were leaving church and coming out into the road. You think your aunt made it home? Vivian asked. She is usually the last one to leave. You want me to go before she gets home? I want you to stay. You think it'll be all right? She'll have to get used to it. I don't want to cause any trouble. There won't be any trouble, I said. We went over all that last Friday. What happened? She wanted to know what had kept me in Bayonne so long. I told her I'd been with you. That's all. That's all. That's all. I want her to like me. She will when she gets to know you. I wish I could say the same for them in Freela Cove. Vivian had met and married a dark-skinned boy while attending Xavier University in New Orleans. She had not told her people about the wedding, because she knew that they would be opposed to it. After she and the boy were married, she took him back to Freela Cove. Everything turned out just as she had feared. Her family had nothing to say to her husband, and hardly anything to say to her. He never went back. When her first child was born, she took the baby to visit. No one held the child, or gave it a present, or any attention. That was 3 years ago, and she had not been home since, not even when the second child was born, nor when she separated from her husband. One of her sisters visited her sometimes, and occasionally a male cousin would see her in Bayonne. Her mother and aunts wrote letters. There was no other communication. Vivian and I stood on the porch and watched my aunt, Miss Emma, Miss Eloise, and Inez come down the quarter. I saw my aunt looking at Vivian's little blue Chevrolet parked in front of the house, then looking toward the house. The women around her went on talking, but she was much more concerned with Vivian and me than with their conversation. They stopped before the house, and I saw Miss Eloise talking to my aunt. I am sure she was asking her whether they could come in or not. My aunt said yes, because they all proceeded into the yard, walking Indian file, my aunt in front. I introduced her to Vivian as soon as she came up the steps. Miss, my aunt said, and gave a slight nod. She didn't look at me. I introduced Vivian to the other women. Howdy do, Miss Eloise said. How are you, Miss Emma said. Glad to know you, Inez said. But they were not glad to know her. They didn't feel comfortable at all. They were at my aunt's house, and they were not about to show much more enthusiasm than she had shown. They went inside in single file. You could smell their sweet powder all over the place. You think I ought to go? Vivian said. No. Come on inside. We had to pass through my aunt's room to go back into the kitchen. Tante Lou and the other women had taken off their hats and coats and laid them along with their pocketbooks on the bed. They were in the kitchen, sitting at the table. My aunt had brought them here for coffee and cake. I'll have to make some more coffee, I said. I'll make my own coffee, my aunt said. I'll make it, I said. Not here. Vivian and I drank the coffee, and I'll make more. That's all there is to it. You gonna walk over me? She asked. No, ma'am. I'm going to walk around you, I said. But I'm going to make the coffee. I filled the kettle with water and set it on the stove. My aunt was watching me. Her friends, sitting at the table, were quiet. Grant, Vivian said, I think just be quiet. You taking over my house? My aunt said, no, ma'am. But we drank the coffee. And this is the woman I'm going to marry one day, so you might as well start getting along right now. The women at the table did not look at us and were afraid to look at one another. My aunt was like a boulder in the road, unmovable, so I had to go around her. She could see that I was not going to change my mind. And she had three choices. She could stop me physically, she could leave the room, or she could sit down at the table with her friends. She was afraid to approach me physically, because I might leave and not come back. If she left the kitchen, then her friends would leave. If she sat at the table, only her pride would be hurt. She thought that was best. "How was service today, Miss Eloise?" I asked. "Oh, fine." She said it so fast it sounded like only one word. I grinned to myself. "You find anything funny in that, mister?" my aunt asked, looking at me again. "No, ma'am," I said. She stared at me long enough to let me know that it was not over between her and me, not yet. She turned to Vivian, not saying anything, just contemplating her. The other women were quiet, looking either down at the table or out the back door, never at one another. "I hear you from Freela Cove," my aunt said to Vivian. "Yes, ma'am." "I hear they don't like dark-skinned people back there." "Some of them don't," Vivian said. "Not all of them?" my aunt questioned her. "No, ma'am." "How about your own folks?" "I don't visit back there," Vivian said. "You don't love your mama? You don't love your daddy?" "I love both of them," Vivian said, and looked at me, "but I have to live my own life." "You go to church?" "I'm Catholic." My aunt looked at Vivian and nodded her head as if she was thinking, "What else could you possibly be?" "You went to church today?" "I went to 9 o'clock mass," Vivian said. "You going next Sunday?" "Yes, ma'am." "Sunday after that?" "I hope so." "This one," my aunt said, nodding toward me but still looking at Vivian, "he don't have a church." "Why y'all gonna do then?" "We'll work it out," Vivian said. "You going to leave your church?" "I hope I don't have to," Vivian said. "But if I had to, then I suppose I would." "You'll leave your church and just become nothing?" "We'll work it out," Vivian said. My aunt nodded her head. "I hope you know what you're doing, young lady." "I think the water is hot," I said. I poured water over the fresh coffee grounds and watched the container fill up. And when the level went down, I poured in more water. Now the aroma of the coffee had taken over from the lady's powder, or maybe it was because I was closer to the coffee pot than I was to the table. "Get some dishes out of that safe," I said to Vivian. "Cups and saucers and 4 plates for cake."
"Grant,
just do what I said," I told him. She brought the 4 cups and saucers to the stove on a tray, and I poured hot water into one of the cups. Vivian rinsed out all the other cups and poured the water into the dishpan on the window shelf. She set the tray of cups on the shelf and went back to the safe and began to cut slices of cake and put them on plates. By the time she had finished, enough coffee had dripped, and I was pouring it into the cups. Vivian put a fork on each plate and placed cake before the women. They said thanks, but they said it quietly. Vivian came back to the window for the coffee. Everyone said thanks again. "Thank you, ma'am," my aunt said politely. My aunt knew how to make you feel that she was of a lower caste and you were being too kind to her. That was the picture she presented, but not nearly how she felt. Vivian and I went out onto the porch. "I'm glad to get out of there," Vivian said. "She's pulled that jazz on others," I said. "It's not going to work this time, though." "Well, I see that mine are not the only ones," Vivian said. "It's not the same thing," I said. "Far from being the same thing." Vivian became very quiet. Then, "Well, I better be going." "Something I said?" "No, it's getting late, that's all. I have to get my purse and tell them goodbye." She went back inside, and she must have stood a good distance away from the table because I could hear them clearly from the porch. "I come to say I'm leaving," Vivian said. "It was good meeting you all." There was silence a while, then I heard my aunt saying, "You're a lady of quality. Quality ain't cheap." "Thank you, ma'am." "Don't give up God," my aunt said. "No matter what, don't ever do that." "Yes, ma'am." "You're a lady of quality," my aunt repeated. And a pretty young lady, too, Miss Eloise said. That's for sure, Inez chipped in. A pretty young lady. Good manners. Quality is what you have. Quality. They were quiet again. Maybe they didn't have any more to say. Vivian came back outside, and we went out to the car. Well, what do you think of the place? I asked her. Still think it's pastoral? It is pastoral, she said, looking around. One of the Washington boys and a Hebert girl came up from the quarter holding hands. They had just left church, the boy wearing a black suit, white shirt, and a tie. The girl wore a light blue coat over her dress. Both of them spoke to me at the same time, saying, How are you, Mr. Wiggins? And they nodded to Vivian as they went by us, still holding hands. Good luck, I thought to myself. Vivian was watching them, too, as they continued down the quarter. I'm glad I met your aunt and her friends, she said. They'll have a lot to talk about, I said. You think I did okay? With all that quality, how could you fail? Vivian smiled without opening her mouth. I kissed her on the tip of her nose. Uh-uh, she said. Not in public. I have too much quality for that.
Chapter 16. I was walking around the schoolyard with my ruler when I saw my aunt, Reverend Ambrose, and Miss Emma come back down the quarter after seeing Jefferson. The car stopped in front of Miss Emma's house, and the three of them got out and went into the yard. Reverend Ambrose looked over his shoulder toward the church, but the picket fence kept him from seeing me. After they had gone inside the house, I continued around the schoolyard, slapping my leg with the ruler. It was 3:15, nearly time to dismiss the children for the day. I re-entered the church through the front door. Irene Cole and another girl and a boy stood at one of the blackboards. We had discussed our Christmas program, and now they were writing down names of the students who would bring the Christmas tree, as well as those who would decorate it. I went to my desk and tapped my ruler for attention. It's about time to go home. Any questions before we dismiss? Irene? No, sir, she said from the blackboard. Marshall and Clarence and Alec are getting the tree. Surely Odessa and I will see that it's decorated. Mr. Joseph's got some lint cotton in his crib, and we can get some crepe paper from Miss Eloise. She said she had a lot left over from making the Mardi Gras hats. What about the tree, Clarence? Guess we'll just go back into the pasture and get one like we did last year, he grinned. Do you think you might be able to find a little pine tree this time? We'll try, he said, and laughed to himself. The year before, the boys had brought in a small oak tree. They had dragged it through the mud all the way from the pasture, and by the time it got to the school, it had lost many of its leaves. The girls who were to decorate the tree had to wash it clean before putting on the lint cotton and the crepe paper. It turned out to be a beautiful Christmas tree. One other thing before we dismiss class. I want you all to remember one person during this Christmas season. I'm sure I don't have to remind you who I'm thinking about. If there are no other questions, you may collect your things and leave. And I don't want to hear any noise out there in the quarter. Class dismissed. After they had gone, I sat down at the table, looking over the test I had given the sixth graders in geography. The assignment was to draw up a map of Louisiana and write in the names of the parishes in their appropriate places. After about 5 minutes, I heard footsteps entering the church, then saw that one of the boys had stopped halfway down the aisle. I knew what he was going to tell me. Miss Emma says, on your way home, stop by. I nodded my head, and he left, walking slowly until he got to the door. Then he burst out running. I gathered up all my papers, and after closing and locking the back door, I went out through the front. Miss Emma's house was only a short distance down the quarter. They were sitting at the kitchen table drinking coffee when I came in. Some coffee? Miss Emma asked me. No, ma'am. Thomas said you wanted to see me. Sit down, Grant, she said. I could tell by the way she said it, and by the silence of my aunt and Reverend Ambrose, that things had not gone well at the jail. I pulled out a chair and sat down, facing Miss Emma. My aunt and Reverend Ambrose sat opposite each other. "You didn't tell me the truth the other day, did you?" Miss Emma said. "I don't know what you're talking about, Miss Emma." "When you came back from seeing him." "Sure I told you the truth," I said. "No," she shook her head, pressing her lips tight as she looked across the table at me. "He didn't like the food. He didn't ask about me."
"He did last Friday."
"No," she said, and she shook her head again, "'cause I had to hit him today." She stared at me, her lips pressed tight, and she lowered her head. Reverend Ambrose reached out and touched one of her arms, and he said, "Sister Emma, Sister Emma." My aunt put her hand on the other arm and looked at me. A couple of days later, Miss Eloise came up to the house, and from my room I could hear my aunt telling her what happened. Jefferson was asleep, or pretending to be asleep, when they got to his cell. The deputy rattled the big keys in the bars and called Jefferson's name before opening the door. After they had gone inside, the deputy locked the door and told them he would be back in an hour. They could call if they wanted to leave earlier. Jefferson lay down on the bunk with his back to them, and there was no place for them to sit. Miss Emma managed to get a small place to sit by pushing him gently closer to the wall. She passed her hand over his head and his shoulder while she whispered his name.
"Ain't you going to speak to me?" she said. "Ain't you going to speak to your company?"
Finally he turned, looking in their direction. He wasn't seeing them, my aunt told Miss Louise. He acted as though they were not even in the room. His eyes were a total blank, my aunt said. "Just blank, blank," was how she said it.
"I brought you some food," Miss Emma told him. "I brought you a shirt, too, a pretty shirt. You want to see it?"
She took a polo shirt from the paper bag and spread it out with both hands, but he showed no sign of seeing the shirt or even hearing Miss Emma. Reverend Ambrose went up to the bunk and said to him, "Young man, I pray for you every night, and I know the Lord is hearing my prayers. Put all your faith in him, and he will bring you through." That touched something inside him. He looked up at the Reverend, and for a moment it seemed that he would say something, something cruel and mean, my aunt said. She said that standing back, looking at him, she could see his hate for Reverend Ambrose. Miss Emma put the shirt back in the bag and opened the basket with the food. "Come on, eat something for me," she said.
"I brought all the best things you like."
"You brought corn?" the voice said. "Not him," my aunt said, "just the voice. He didn't show a thing in his face. His eyes were blank, blank," my aunt said.
"Corn?"
Miss Emma said.
He didn't answer her. "Rest in years?"
He looked at her, but didn't answer.
"And his eyes were just blank, blank, blank," my aunt said.
He could have been looking at the wall or the floor for all the recognition he showed her.
"This ain't Rosnier's season, Jefferson," Miss Emma told him. "That's in the spring. This is November. Rosnier's all over now."
He didn't look at her with hate as he had the Reverend, but there was no pity there either, my aunt said. He didn't show any feeling at all.
"Corn for a hog," he said.
"Corn for a hog?
A hog, Jefferson? You ain't no hog, Jefferson. You ain't no hog."
"Throw something," he said.
"I'll never throw you nothing, Jefferson," Miss Emma said. "You throw a bone to a dog, slop to a hog. You ain't no hog."
"That's all I'm is," he said, and he turned away from her. "I didn't ask to be born."
"Jefferson?"
Miss Emma said.
"Jefferson!"
He wouldn't answer her, and she used all her great bulk to pull him over.
"You ain't no hog, you hear me? You ain't no hog!"
"That's all I'm is," he said.
"Fatten up to—"
And she slapped him. Then she fell upon him and cried, my aunt told Miss Eloise. My aunt and Reverend Ambrose went to the bunk and tried to pull her away, but she was still slumped over him when the deputy came back to let them go. At her kitchen table now, as I sat there, Miss Emma looked at my aunt.
"What have I done, Lou?" she said. "What I done done. What I done done my master to deserve this."
My aunt saw that she was going to cry, and she stood up and put her arm around her shoulder. "Emma," she said, "Emma, the Lord is merciful."
"What I done done," she cried, "to make my master hate me so."
"The Lord don't hate you, Sister Emma," Reverend Ambrose said, touching her on the arm. "The Lord is with you this moment. He is only testing you." Miss Emma looked up at me, The tears were still rolling down her face. "Go back," she said. "Why, Miss Emma?" "'Cause somebody gonna do something for me before I die."
"Why me?"
"'Cause you're the teacher," my aunt said. I got up from the table. "And where do you think you're going?" Tante Lou said to me. "I don't know," I said, "but I'll go crazy if I stay here, that's for sure."
"You going back up there, Grant?"
"What for?" I said. "What for, Tante Lou? He treated me the same way he treated her. He wants me to feel guilty, just as he wants her to feel guilty."
"Well, I'm not feeling guilty, Tante Lou.
I didn't put him there. I do everything I know how to do to keep people like him from going there. He's not going to make me feel guilty."
"You're going back," she said.
"You ain't going to run from this, Grant."
"Tante Lou," I said. I wanted to take her face into my hands, and I wanted to hold her gently, gently, because anger and screaming were not working. Maybe gentleness would work better. Maybe feeling my hands on her face would make her understand what I was trying to say to her. But as I moved toward her, I could see in her eyes that nothing I said was going to change anything. I left them at that table and went back home to my room.
Chapter 17. Between Monday, when I talked to Miss Emma, and Friday, when I visited Jefferson again, something had happened inside me, and I wasn't so angry anymore. Maybe it was the Christmas season and the children rehearsing their parts for the play. Or maybe it was just me. I could never stay angry long over anything, but I could never believe in anything either for very long. At the jail, I had to go through the usual search. Then, while the young deputy and I walked down the corridor to the cell block, I thought I would feel him out. Of the three of them at the jail, I figured he was the most likely to be honest with me. He was nearer my age, and he seemed better educated than the chief deputy or the sheriff. And I had heard from people in the quarter who knew his people that he had come from pretty good stock. "How's he doing?" I asked. "He's doing all right," the deputy said. "Does he ever eat the food we bring him?" "Some of it," the deputy said. "He leaves a lot of it, and we give it to the other prisoners, like she said. We've all eaten some of it. Good food, too." "How do the other prisoners treat him?" I asked. "They're just curious, that's all, but they don't bother him." "Do they ever talk to you about it?" "The execution?" "Yes. Sometimes they ask me things. I tell them I don't know a thing about it. I've never seen an execution." "Does he ever bring it up?" "No, I'm sure he doesn't even want to... "No, I'm sure he doesn't want to even think about it." "He must think about it," I said. "He must, because I know I do. I've seen myself walk into that chair more than once. I've woken up at night sweating." "How do you take it? That's the question." "I suppose every man wonders about death sometimes in his life." We came up to the landing just before the big door to the cell block. The deputy stopped and looked at me. "Listen," he said, "we might as well call each other by our names. You're Grant, aren't you?" "Grant Wiggins," I said. "Paul Bonin," he said. We shook hands. "Listen," he said, "I'm not going to get too close to him, okay?" "Sure." "I've been warned. You don't get too close to somebody going to be executed. Be decent, treat him right, but that's all. This could get messy before it's over, and I will do my duty." "I feel the same way," I said. We looked at each other a moment, then we continued to the cell block. "What's a day like?" I asked Paul. "He eats one hot meal a day and a sandwich. Lots of beans, cabbage, potatoes, rice, you know. Sometimes the sandwich is the first meal. 10 in the morning, 4 in the evening. He can come out once a week and spend an hour in the day room. Walk, sit-ups, run, anything he wants. Most times he walks or just sits there at the table. Once a week, he gets a shower. We have another prisoner give him a haircut. He's had one since he's been here. The barber can shave him, but you can see his face doesn't need shaving. That's about it." He talk at all to the other prisoners? I asked. I never hear him. The deputy opened the heavy steel door to the cell block.
Well, 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 if it ain't Mr. Rockefeller,
one of the prisoners said. He wore the green coveralls given to all the prisoners who did not have their own clothes. He also wore a red knit cap, his own.
Mr. Rockefeller always leave you chicken and biscuits, he went on, but no bread for the cigarettes.
Just cool it, Henry Martin, the deputy said. You won't get chicken or biscuits either, you keep that up. I hope you brought some pralines, another prisoner said.
Anything, another one said. This jailhouse food enough to kill a man.
Then don't eat it, Paul said to him.
What, and starve to death?
The prisoner laughed. We came down to the last cell, Jefferson's cell, and Paul let me inside. See you in a while, he said as he locked the door. Jefferson sat on the bunk, slumped forward a little, his big hands clasped together down between his legs. He was looking through the barred window toward the sycamore tree, where several blackbirds were perched on a limb. How's it going? I said to him. He nodded his head, but he didn't turn to look at me. I brought you some food.
I ain't hungry.
Well, you might get hungry later, I said, and set the large paper bag of food on the end of the bunk. I was speaking to Paul, the deputy. He told me you always share with the other prisoners. If they want it, they can have it. I looked at his back. Then I went by him and stood under the window, facing him. He was still gazing upward, and I noticed his eyes, large and inflamed. Since my last visit, he had gotten a very close haircut, which exposed the structure of his almost triangular head. Jefferson, we have to talk, I said. He continued looking above my head toward the barred window. When your Nanan came back from seeing you the other day, she broke down crying.
Everybody cry, he said. I cry.
Is that what you want? Her to come home crying every time she sees you? He didn't answer. You can keep her from crying, I said. You can make it easier for her. You can do her that favor. He continued to look above my head toward the barred window. She wants somebody to do something for her before she dies.
That's for I die, he said, lowered his eyes to look at me.
He repeated it. That's for I die. Is it asking too much, Jefferson, to show some concern for her?
'Cause I'm going to die anyhow? That's what you're trying to say?
Now it was I who didn't answer.
That's what you're trying to say, Mr. Teacher? He asked.
We're all going to die, Jefferson.
Tomorrow, Mr. Teacher, that's when you're going to die? Next week?
I don't know when I'm going to die, Jefferson. Maybe tomorrow, maybe next week, maybe today. That's why I try to live as well as I can every day and not hurt people, especially people who love me, people who have done so much for me, people who have sacrificed for me. I don't want to hurt those people. I want to help those people as much as I can.
You can talk like that. You know you're going to walk out here in an hour. I bet you wouldn't be talking like that if you knowed you was going to stay in here.
In here or out of here, Jefferson, what does it benefit you to hurt someone who loves you, who has done so much for you?
I never asked to be born.
Neither did I said, but here I am, and I'm trying to make the best of it.
Like coming here vexing me? He asked.
Am I vexing you, Jefferson?
He grunted. Just keep on vexing me, he said. I bet you I say something about that old yellow woman you go with.
You're speaking of Vivian?
Just keep on vexing me, he said.
If you're talking about Vivian, it's Vivian who keeps me coming here.
Keep on vexing me, he said. See what I won't say. Just keep on vexing me.
Go on and say anything you want to say, Jefferson.
Keep on vexing me, bet you I'll scream, he said.
So Guidry would come up here and tell me to get out? Is that it?
Is that it, Jefferson?
I had been trying my best not to become angry again, but nothing I said made a difference. He just sat there grinning at me.
Go on and scream, Jefferson. Go on and scream for Guidry if that's what you want.
We looked at each other, and I could see in those big reddened eyes that he was not going to scream. He was full of anger, and who could blame him, but he was no fool. He needed me, and he wanted me here, if only to insult me.
Her old pussy ain't no good, he said.
My heart suddenly started pumping too fast. I made a fist of my right hand. If he'd been standing, I would have hit him. If he'd been any place else, I would have made him get up, and I would have hit him. I would have hit any other man for saying that. but I recognized his grin for what it was, the expression of the most heart-rending pain I had ever seen on anyone's face. I rubbed my fist with my left hand, and gradually I began to relax. "That lady you spoke of, boy, cares a lot about you," I said to him. "She's waiting at that school right now for me to bring her news about you. That's a lady you spoke of, boy. That's a lady. Because it's she who keeps me coming here. Not your nanin, not my aunt, Vivian. If I didn't have Vivian, I wouldn't be in this damn hole. Because I know damn well I'm not doing any good for you or for any of the others. Do you hear what I'm saying to you? Do you?" I saw that grin slowly fade as he lowered his eyes toward the floor. When he looked up again, I saw tears in those big, reddened eyes. "Manners is for the living," he said. He looked at me a while. Then he swung around and knocked the bag of food off the bunk. The bag burst open on the floor, and there was fried chicken and biscuits and baked sweet potatoes all over the place. "Food for the living, too," he said. When the deputy came back to let me out, I had picked up all the food and put it back into the torn paper bag, and I had placed the bag on the small steel shelf by the washbowl. Jefferson and I had not exchanged a word for 15 minutes. He had lain down on the bunk, facing the wall. I heard Paul coming down the block, speaking to the prisoners, calling them by their first names, threatening this one with hard work, praising another one for being good. He looked at Jefferson as he let me out of the cell. Jefferson lay with his back toward us. "How did it go?" he asked. "Okay." We went down the cell block, and the prisoners asked me what I had brought Jefferson to eat. I didn't answer. Just before we reached the heavy metal door, Henry Martin yelled out to me,
"Goodbye, Mr. Rockefeller. I'll be here when you come back."
"That's for sure," Paul said to him. He opened the steel door, and we went out. "Sheriff wants to see you in his office," Paul said. "Is something the matter?" The deputy shrugged his shoulders. "He just told me that he wanted to see you before you left." The sheriff was talking on the phone when Paul and I came into his office. The chief deputy was talking to the fat man, whom I had seen at Pichot's house. The sheriff sat back in his chair, his cowboy boots propped on his desk. He was talking to someone at the state prison in Angola. The chief deputy and the fat man were talking about fishing at Old River. They continued their conversation for another 5 or 10 minutes, as if I weren't there. Paul stood beside me a while, then he went into another office. I stood waiting. The sheriff hung up the telephone and looked at me over the tips of his boots. "Well, Professor, making any headway?" he asked. "I don't know," I said. "You've been seeing him a month. You still don't know if you're making any headway?" "No, sir." The chief deputy and the fat man had quit talking, and they were looking at me, too. "You wouldn't be trying to hide something now, would you?" the sheriff asked me. "No, sir." "Glad to hear that," he said. "Hear that, Frank? He ain't hiding nothing." The fat man grunted and looked at me. Guidry drew his boots from the top of the desk and dropped his feet heavily to the floor. "Women," he said, "always coming up with something new. Now they want all y'all to meet in the bullpen, picnic-like." He looked at me as though I was supposed to know what he was talking about. "Well, what do you think?" he asked me when I didn't offer an answer. "That's up to you, Sheriff," I said. "Yes, I know that," he said. "But the things they come up with. They want to meet him in the day room or another comfortable room. Comfortable room where they can all sit down, because they can't all sit down in that cell. You ever heard of anything like that before?" "I don't know what you're talking about, Sheriff," I said. "Don't you, Professor?" "No, sir, I don't." He regarded me a while, and so did the chief deputy and the fat man. The deputy was looking very mean. "You don't know they came up to my wife?" the sheriff asked me. "I don't know a thing that you're talking about, Sheriff." "They came up to the house and said they couldn't sit down, and could she, please, ma'am, speak to me about arranging a place so they can sit down. And you don't know anything about that?"
"No, sir, I don't."
"You playing with me, Professor?" the sheriff asked.
"Sheriff, I just don't know what you're talking about.
I would learn later. Miss Emma, my aunt, and Reverend Ambrose had visited the sheriff's wife a day after they had last seen Jefferson. The sheriff's wife greeted them graciously and set a precedent by having them sit in the living room while her maid served them coffee. They talked about little things before they came to their purpose in coming there.
The sheriff's wife was stunned. She nearly spilled her coffee. What was wrong with the cell? Wasn't it big enough? Yes, but they couldn't all sit down. Was it necessary that they all sit down at the same time? Couldn't they take turns? She was sure that Reverend Ambrose didn't mind standing. And maybe Jefferson could stand up, too, and let Tanty Lou and Miss Emma sit down. It was then that Miss Emma reminded the sheriff's wife of all the things she had done for the family over the years. The sheriff's wife was suddenly taken with a splitting headache. She wondered where the maid had gone to, but she didn't call for her. She frowned and rubbed her temples. She told Miss Emma that she would see what she could do. "But don't count on it," she said. "The sheriff makes up his own mind in these matters." "Just speak to him, if you don't mind," Miss Emma said. "I done a lot for you and your family over all these years." "Oh, Lord, do I know," the sheriff's wife said. "Do I know, do I know, do I know? I speak to the sheriff. Lord, I'll be glad when all this is over." Miss Emma dropped her coffee cup on the floor and started calling on God. "I didn't mean it that way," the sheriff's wife said. "God in heaven knows I didn't mean it that way. Lou, Reverend Ambrose, can't y'all do something? The Lord knows I didn't mean it that way." "Women," the sheriff said to me, "always coming up with something new." He looked at his deputy. "Well, Clark, what do you think?" Clark's gray eyes looked like marbles in his big face.
"Let him stay where he's at."
"My sentiments exactly," the sheriff said. "But if we put him in handcuffs and leg chains?"
"I wouldn't even bother," Clark said.
"I wouldn't either," the sheriff said, "but you got these women."
"He ain't here for no picnic," Clark said. "He killed Mr. Gropé. Let him stay right there in that last cell till that last day."
"What do you say, Frank?" the sheriff asked the fat man. The fat man shrugged his shoulders.
"I'm just standing here."
"I go to him and I leave it up to him," the sheriff said to me. "If he wants to come in the day room in shackles, all right. If he wants to stay in his cell unshackled, all right. But cell or day room, if I notice any aggravation, I stop all visits. You see, I know you haven't done a thing yet. Boys on the block tell me you haven't done a thing, and I doubt if you ever will." I didn't answer him, but I was thinking, "Sheriff, you don't know how right you are." "You can take her this message," the sheriff said. "He can meet her in the day room if he wants, but he will be shackled. Every moment of the rest of his life, he's going to know he's in jail, and he's going to be here till the end. This ain't no school, and it ain't no picnic ground. All right?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good. I'll see you later, Professor."
Chapter 18. As he had promised, the sheriff went to Jefferson and asked him if he would like to meet his visitors in the day room instead of his cell. The sheriff explained that he would be shackled hand and feet there. He also told Jefferson that it was entirely up to him and that his wishes would be carried out.
"If that's what they want," Jefferson said.
"No, not what they want, what you want."
"If that's what they want," Jefferson repeated.
"Is it yes, then?"
"If that's what they want," Jefferson said, "I'm going to die anyhow."
When Miss Emma and my aunt and Reverend Ambrose went to the courthouse, they were led to the day room by the young deputy, Paul. The large room contained three tables made of steel, with benches attached on either side, also of steel. There were no other visitors in the day room, and Miss Emma selected the center table. Paul told them that he would be back in a few minutes. While he was gone, Miss Emma took out the food and placed it on the table. She set places for four, two on either side of the table. My aunt and Reverend Ambrose stood back watching her. My aunt would say later that Miss Emma went about setting the table the same way she would have done at home, humming her termination song to herself. "This gon' be his place, and this gon' be my place," she said. My aunt said that Miss Emma, still humming to herself, passed her hand over the table to make sure there was no dust, no specks there, just as she would do at the home. "That's your place there, Lou, and that's yours right there, Reverend Ambrose," she said. "Don't it look nice? Ain't this much better?" My aunt and Reverend Ambrose agreed that it looked nice and that it was much better than the cell. Then they heard the chains.
and a moment later the door at the far end of the room opened and Jefferson came in, followed by the deputy. Jefferson had not been chained before, and he took long steps that caused him to trip, my aunt said. He came to the table like somebody half-blind, and he didn't sit down until Paul told him to do so. Paul told him that he had to stay in that one place until he was returned to his cell. "He ain't gonna move," Miss Emma said. "I'm gonna see to that. I thank you kindly." "You understand, don't you, Jefferson?" Paul said. "I hear you," Jefferson said. "He gon' mind," Miss Emma said. "I'm gon' see to that." "Y'all have a good dinner," Paul said, and left. "He come from good stock," Miss Emma said. "Y'all sit down. Well, Jefferson, how you feelin'?" He did not answer her. He sat with bowed head, his cuffed hands down between his knees under the table. My aunt and Reverend Ambrose sat down. Miss Emma dished up the food. Mustard greens with pieces of pork fat mixed in. There was stewed beef, meat, rice, and biscuits. A little cake for dessert, my aunt said. "You gonna eat for me, Jefferson?" Miss Emma asked him. He kept his head bowed, his shackled hands under the table, and he did not answer her. "Y'all eat if I feed you?" she asked. When he did not answer her, she dished up a small piece of meat and some mustard greens on the spoon and held it up to his mouth. He would not open his mouth. Miss Emma looked at my aunt, and my aunt, who had been trying to eat, could see all the hurt in her face. "When I came up there a couple of days later, the chief deputy told me I could meet Jefferson in his cell or in the day room. I told him it didn't matter to me where we met. The chief deputy told me it didn't matter to him either, but he told Paul to take me to the day room. I sat at the center table just as Miss Emma and my aunt and Reverend Ambrose had 2 days before, and I heard the chains out along the cell block before I saw anyone. Then they came in, Jefferson in front, shackled, walking with short steps, his head bowed and his shoulders stooped. They came up to the table, and Paul told him to sit down. He sat without looking at me, his shoulders hanging low and closer together than they should be. "I'll be back," Paul said. "Can we walk?" I asked him. "He had his exercise," Paul said. "I'll have to ask Clark." "No, that's all right," I said. "Maybe next time." Paul left. "How's it going?" I said. "All right," Jefferson said without raising his head. "You want something to eat?" "I ain't hungry," he said. "Yes, you are," I said. "I know I am." There was store-bought bread, fried pork chops, and baked sweet potatoes. I put some of it in front of him and some in front of me. I started eating. "Come on, eat something," I said. He raised his head slowly and studied me a while. He had lost some weight. What had been a round, smooth face when he first came here was beginning to show some bone structure. His eyes were still bloodshot. I had seen them many times in my sleep the past month. "What you want?" he asked me. I was eating. I shrugged my shoulders. "Just want you to eat something, that's all." "What you want?" he asked again. His expression hadn't changed, and there was no change of inflection in his voice. His reddened eyes accused me of wanting something without saying it. "Us to talk," I said. "About what?" "I don't know," I said. "Anything you want to talk about. What do you want to talk about?" "That chair," he said. He watched me now because he knew he had caught me off guard. I looked at him a moment, then I started eating again. That chair was the last thing that I wanted to talk about. "We're starting our Christmas program," I said. But I could see that he was thinking about other things. "You remember those Christmas programs when you were in school?" "Is Christmas?" he asked. But he was not thinking about Christmas. He was thinking about something else, and he knew that I knew he was thinking about something else. "No, Christmas is still a few weeks off," I said, "but we're getting ready." "That's when he was born, or that's when he died?" he asked. "Who?" I said. He looked at me, knowing that I knew who he was talking about. "Born," I said. "That's right," he said. "Easter, when they nailed him to the cross, and he never said a mumbling word." I had not finished eating, but I knew I couldn't eat any more. I put the rest of the pork chop and the slice of light bread on the napkin before me. "Jefferson, do you know what moral means?" I asked him. He looked at me, knowing that I knew what he was thinking about. "Obligation," I said. "Do you know what obligation means?" He didn't answer, but he kept looking at me. No matter how bad off we are, I said, we still owe something. You owe something, Jefferson, not to me, surely not to that sheriff out there, but to your godmother. You must show her some understanding, some kind of love. That's for humans, he said. I ain't no human. Then why do you speak, Jefferson? I said. Human beings are the only creatures on earth who can talk. Why do you talk and wear clothes? Why do you wear clothes? You trying to get me wool gathered? He said. I'm not trying to confuse you, Jefferson. She loves you, and I want you to give her something. Something that she can be proud of. Hogs don't give nothing. Hogs don't leave nothing, he said. Jefferson, do you like coming out here, or you prefer staying in that cell? Anything y'all want, he said, don't matter to me. It matters to her, Jefferson. Out here she can sit down, he grunted. I'm the one gonna have to sit down. You can be kinder to her, Jefferson. Every time she comes up here, she comes back to the quarter looking worse and worse. She ought to stay home, he said. All she'd do is worry more if she didn't see you. Hogs don't worry. Hogs just know, he said. Hogs don't know anything, Jefferson, I said. Only human beings know. Only human beings worry. This hog know, fattening up for Christmas. Kill him at Christmas time, he said. Nobody is going to die at Christmas, I said. How you know, they told you? Nobody told me anything, I said. I just know nothing is going to happen at Christmas. I'll be glad when it's over, he said. Old hog, get him some rest then. Do you want me to leave, Jefferson? Leave when you want. Old hog don't care. He lowered his head. The chains jangled under the table. I wanted to leave, but it was too early. The sheriff would have had his proof that I hadn't reached Jefferson, that I was giving up. They found a pine tree this year, I said, a nice little pine tree. His head was bowed. He didn't answer. His hair had begun to grow back, but you could still see the big bones of his skull. A half hour later, Paul came in to return him to his cell. Jefferson walked in, short steps, his head bowed, his arms hanging low, his shoulders too close together. After locking him in, Paul came back to the day room, and he and I walked down to the main floor together. "What do you think?" he asked. "I don't know, but that's what she wants." Paul nodded. He understood. He had come from good stock.
That's all the time we have for today's readings from Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them in our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at triangleReadingService.org. I will repeat both of those at the end of this broadcast. Once again, I'm Kirk Benrood. Our readers, Tom Haynes, Pam Vesper, Robbie Merritt, Awen Fulton, and Dan and Julie Oliver, thank you for listening. The music was supplied by Joni Madden of the Irish-American band Cherish the Ladies. Our phone number once again is 919-832-5138. Our web address once again is triangleReadingService.org.